Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
I'm so badass, I use gold bullets.
Also joining us this week is Kevin Grant, author of Any Gun Can Play, The Essential Guide to Euro Westerns.
Hi, how you doing?
This week's episode is being brought to you by Boulevard Movies. That's boulevardmovies.com, a great source for movies like Django Kill, If You Live, Shoot. Yes, that's the name of the film. Originally, it was called If You Live, Shoot, or Se Si Vivo, Spara. It's a highly stylized spaghetti western starring Thomas Millian, not necessarily as Django, but as the stranger, who after being double-crossed, shot, and crawling out of a grave, makes his way to a place that his two Indian friends call the Unhappy Place. The film has a somewhat traditional villain, Zorro, and two more unconventional ones, a saloon owner and a pious freak. Actually, the whole town of the Unhappy Place is kind of a villain unto itself. So, Kevin, can you talk about the ways that Django Kill kind of stands out as a spaghetti western and how it got to be that way?
First reason it stands out is because, I mean, it literally does stand out from all the rest. Sure, it's got some of the same plot elements, but the way that the director and his co-writer treat them completely from left field. It just subverts expectations the whole way through. It sets you up for what you think is going to be maybe a straightforward revenge plot. We might think that the bandits who ambush Thomas Millian's character at the beginning, but they don't finish him off, you think, okay, he's going to make them pay for that. He's going to track them down to the town. He's going to kill them. But they go into this town, and they become victims of the town itself. And so Millian suddenly has a completely different role. Throughout, it just plays with convention and expectations quite deliciously. And that's really what sets it apart from all the others.
The one thing that really stood out to me was beyond, as you were talking about, sort of the plot elements and how everyone's kind of a villain and a badass, and things are kind of filtered through these weird things, and we'll get into it, is that it really is hyper-stylized. It doesn't sort of play in reality. It's not trying to be reality, I don't think. And I think that's what I find really interesting and fascinating about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes it gets criticized for this extreme stylization and the fact that it does seem to take place in this bizarre version of the West, which, you know, could never have existed in reality. But as Rob was saying, there's no intention of making it play like the real West or even like any other kind of Western. You know, it takes place in a strange world, all of its own, has its own rules. And Acquesti also, the director Giulio Acquesti, also feels quite free to break all the rules and even make up some of his own. You know, it doesn't really matter in this movie that guns seem to fire 20 bullets before needing to be reloaded. I don't think he really cared about things like that. He was kind of set, had this strange, crazy vision of his own, and he followed it through.
And I would say, as I was watching it, I was thinking about sort of what it reminded me of in terms of that stylization with other people. And I think it's really simple for people to go, oh, you know, there could be like Lynch aspects, or I would even say Luis Buñuel to some extent, or even, to be honest, a lot of almost underground film of the era. I was thinking maybe like if Paul Morrissey made a Western, you know, under the Andy Warhol moniker, it might be something like this.
Yeah, I think you're quite right there. We'll get on to some of the aspects that perhaps Morrissey would have entertained as well. I'm thinking of the black-clad bad guys. I think he would have had fun with those.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for me, it reminded me a lot of El Topo or High Plains Drifter, yes. Right? but even more strange than that film. But I like that kind of supernatural tone to it.
Sure, sure. I think this was possibly the first Western to really introduce that idea to this extent.
Yeah, which is strange because, you know, the history of Westerns, I mean, even thinking back like with some of Bret Hart's fiction and stuff, you know, there was that kind of supernatural thing that could run through a Western, but really hadn't been brought up as much as something like Django Kill.
As with a lot of the changes that the European directors brought into the Western, I think maybe it took an outsider, somebody completely out of that context, to perhaps explore these areas some more, at least on film.
I was rewatching the original Django the other day, and I never really realized just how similar that one is to A Fistful of Dollars as far as the way that he kind of is coming into town and exploiting things and stuff. But this really reminds me of that as well, as far as having the two, and I won't call them bosses, but having the two separate guys in town that he's kind of bouncing between, the saloon owner and the real kind of pious a-hole that keeps his wife locked up down the street.
I think in terms of the spaghetti westerns in general, the plot was really, were not what sold these movies. You know, they would basically rotate about three or four of them, and it just was down to the writers and the directors and the photographers and the musicians and so on to put their own spin on it. But yeah, you're quite right. Again, that's something I was talking about earlier in terms of what Giulio Questi does here. He could have played it like A Fistful of Dollars type western, where Milian just plays off the two guys in town against themselves and somehow ends up with the loot. But it doesn't work out like that at all.
Yeah, I love his two Indian friends that are just there to kind of help him out, and they just want to know what it looked like when he crossed over to the other side.
Yeah, yeah. He has a kind of what can we say, shamanistic power over them. They find him at the beginning of the movie, literally crawling out of his grave in the desert, and they're fascinated because they think he's come back from the other side.
We stay with you, be your companions, but you tell us of happy hunting grounds you've seen, on the other side of River of Life.
You who have seen the land of the dead must give us the wisdom you have learned from the mouths of the great gods. If you remember and tell us these things, we will serve you and follow you.
They follow him around and they repeatedly ask him for information about what it was like. He never tells them anything. He doesn't know. You know, he's just happy that they found him, basically, and they happen to make him a nice stash of gold bullets as well, which was kind.
And I thought that was interesting, that whole interplay between the Indians trying to figure out what's on the other side. And you can kind of see that maybe this was a Christ metaphor or a Lazarus metaphor as he was crawling out of the grave. And maybe them as disciples of this guy who didn't want to be a reluctant messiah to them in some way.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, the whole resurrection and crucifixion motif, because, I mean, later in the movie, of course, he gets tortured, as every spaghetti western hero must get tortured during the movie. He gets tortured, and it's a good old crucifixion as well. So Questi has some fun with that, just like so many Italian directors had fun with religious imagery, you know, coming from a Catholic background. I don't think they could really help but put that into their movies.
Yeah, I like that the town is really just this horrible place of corruption where it's just everything just seems wrong from the get-go with it.
As I say, you know, you see these really bad villains walking into this sleepy town and you think, Christ, this town is not going to last long. These guys are going to terrorize it. But there's all those odd little images that they notice when they're walking into town. Children doing strange things. There's a guy with his foot on his niece's head. There are people fighting and just really weird things happen. There's a small mammal. I think it's a hedgehog or something, but it's a crippled hedgehog. You know, it's just weird elements that Questi puts in there. And just enough to plant doubt in your mind and also in the minds of the guys, these badass villains, immediately they can sense that something isn't right here and they're nervous.
And I think that, Mike, that might be where the El Topo element, you would see the corollary, because there's the whole thing where he comes into town in El Topo and there's all, you know, the town's all weird and there's weird folks in the town. And then, if it's not in El Topo, because I haven't seen it in a while, but I know it's definitely in other Jodorowsky films where he's got animals or he's got like animals that are a little bizarre. And they're the mutants or something. And that I think all of those things would obviously echo back to Jodorowsky. Yeah, I would definitely say that would probably be a connection there.
There's a kind of surrealistic edge to Jodorowsky's work, to Questi's films. They have this own sort of twisted version of reality with, like you say, everyone's kind of off in their movies. They're either all bad or there are freaks and, you know, mutants. There's just this whole worldview that's kind of like a distorted mirror image of reality, but very much not reality itself.
Yeah, I think Zorro and his men would definitely fit in perfectly with El Topo, as far as that opening scene where you have in El Topo, I should say the opening of El Topo, where you've got those guys who are kind of terrorizing the monks and just doing these horrible things to them. I think that Zorro would probably enjoy that as well. Maybe not as overtly, but I have to say that his black-clad pistoleros with their very fancy shirts and just the way that they kind of fawn over Templar's son after they kidnap him. Yeah, I can definitely see that these guys would probably all get along at a party.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And this is where I think it was Robbie brought up Paul Morrissey earlier on. You definitely see that maybe in a Morrissey Western.
There was a sort of a camp element. I mean, we were dealing with sort of this implied or even at times overt reference to homosexuality within the leader and then also within the various gang members. It's kind of odd, I mean, considering it's 1967.
And I think some of this has to do with Questy himself and his background. And he being a partisan in World War II and was very much on the left politically. I don't know whether he was actually a Marxist, but perhaps close to Marxism. But anyway, very much left politically. And so he'd been fighting fascists during the war. And I think his intention for the muchachos, by having them all dressed in black, those were his black shirts. Those were his fascist black shirts. And just to underline his loathing for them, he made them all degenerate homosexuals. You know, that was perhaps how he honestly felt about the fascist black shirts. You know, all these guys hanging around, they were all sadists. And he thought, well, I'm going to take it one step further. I'm going to make them all degenerate homosexuals and in fact rapists, because they do have their way evidently with Ray Lovelock's character, the young man, and of course then after it all shoots himself, can't live with the shame.
You could go over to Salo with that and the whole thing that Pasolini did with the use of fascists and degenerate sexuality.
I think Pasolini would have liked this Western.
That suicide of the young Templar is just so strange. I mean, that he commits suicide in the way that he does and that it's all off screen, and you don't necessarily know if he was shot or if he shot himself, but then it is fairly apparent because there's no one else up at the same time. Just yet another weird turn that this Western takes, and that it was even a man being kidnapped and held for ransom rather than a woman kind of turns a typical, you know, Western cliche on its head as well.
From what Questy has said, they had intended that whole horrible drunken sequence where all the machachos have kidnapped the young Templar Ray Lovelock and are sort of leering all over him and touching him up and everything. I think he had intended that sequence to be a lot more graphic. I think we were to have seen him literally being buggered to death or something like that. But perhaps they thought there's enough nastiness going on in this movie already. We'll never get away with this. So they just implied it by having him wake up the next morning. You know, his clothes are all disheveled. He takes a gun and does what he thinks is the only decent thing left to do.
When it looks like he shoots himself in the side, too.
Yeah, that's another weird thing. I'm not sure how he would have got that angle. Maybe he didn't want to spoil his good looks. I don't know.
Yeah, you would think even if he shot himself in the heart, but to shoot himself in the side, I guess it kind of, going back to the whole Christ thing, too, it's kind of almost in the same position as the spear wound on Christ's side, I guess.
You might have something there. I wouldn't be surprised if that was very deliberate.
Because I was thinking when they bring him into town and they carry him into his father's house, his arms are all outstretched as well. So it's almost like there's two crucifixions in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Questy intended him to be, he was his symbol of innocence in this thoroughly corrupted world, a kind of a Jesus figure, but also, a martyr as well.
I have to say, if there's one character that I would have liked to have seen more of in the film, it would have been Zorro's parrot.
Yes, I think he could have done with a couple more scenes.
I would have liked him to have teamed up with the stranger at some point.
Maybe he could have flown at Zorro and distracted him during a shootout or something. He has some good lines, though, and he gets, you know, gets to drink some hard liquor. So he makes an impression.
Give me a drink!
All right, you dirty old drunk. It's a pity you don't understand what my muchachos mean to me. They make me so happy in their black uniforms.
The time has come, Sorrow! The time has come! Too late! Too late! Too late!
talking again about as far as like supernatural elements and everything, I like that for a while, it seems that Milian is the only person that really sees the woman up in the window that's being held captive. And I'm not sure for the longest time when I'm watching this movie the first time, if she is a ghost or if she is, you know, someone that's real. But it just seems like he's the only one that pays attention. He's the only one that sees her. And then when he finally does meet her, she does have that, you know, ghostly white pallor to her.
Yeah, she does. She does. She looks like one of the heroines or the witches from early 60s Italian horror movies. This is another way in which Quest throws us off the trail, because, okay, Milian sees this woman trapped up there. She asks him for help. He doesn't help her as such. He's quite happy to have his way with her, but she turns out to be completely crazy anyway. He doesn't actually do anything practical to save her, much as he might like to. And that's another way in which the film just goes off the trail completely.
We don't know, like, when her husband is talking about her as being crazy, it's like, okay, is he kind of, you know, gaslighting her, or what's the real deal going on? Is she really crazy? Because when she comes to Milian's room, she seems fairly rational, but then the more we see of her, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe he was right.
Yeah, as bad as that guy is, you know, he does have a point, I think, where she is concerned.
The way that she turns herself over to Milian so quickly, the husband is in danger of being cuckolded the whole time, and then just immediately becomes, you know, as soon as he lets her out of the room, she goes ahead and cuckolds him.
Yes, I think she was just waiting for the opportunity, really. Maybe that's why he has that lock on the door. Otherwise, she'll be after every man who comes within breathing space.
And the other thing is the other guy's wife, the saloon owner's wife, really kind of a strange performance there, and just the way that her son is kind of obsessed with her a little bit. I mean, by him taking out revenge on her clothes just seemed like an odd thing to happen.
Yeah. That's another crazy scene. I think with Tendler and Florey as well, the girl we're just talking about, Questy there, I think anyway, is attacking the bourgeois mentality and the hypocrisy of the bourgeois. And as well as their greed, when Tendler's son is kidnapped and held for ransom by Zorro and his men, Florey is the first one who says to Tendler, you know, we can't give any gold, they're going to kill him anyway, don't give up any gold. And even Tendler comes to agree with this and tries to call Zorro's bluff and won't even, you know, try to rescue his son. So I think the two of them, Florey and Tendler, are complicit in the boy's death, because they do nothing, they value the gold more than they value the life of their son. And then, of course, when they have the son back, they think that they find that his coffin is a very convenient place to actually hide their share of the gold. So it kind of ties in there.
Yeah, which kind of helps us tie the whole story back to a Django idea, even though this wasn't necessarily a Django film.
That's right, because then we get a great scene in the graveyard. And you can't have a good Django film without something happening in a graveyard, I don't think. You know, it was a fantastic showdown at the end of the original Django. You get a great scene here where the muchachos are just going around ripping open every grave to try and find where the gold is hidden. So yeah, you've got to have a graveyard, a cemetery in a Django film. You have to have one.
Yeah, and you kind of get a bonus with this one, since we have Milian kind of crawling out of a grave at the beginning.
Two graves, yeah.
The other thing, talking about sort of this commentary on greed and the value of greed over life and people, is the whole gold bullet scene. And I can understand why when you watch the new restored cut of this film, that scene seems to have been trimmed down a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme. I think that Questy and his co-writer, Franco Arcalli, must have intended that scene to be sort of like a snapshot of how they saw capitalism as being so rapacious and as dehumanizing, desensitizing people to any other values, because they literally, as soon as they find out, hey, this guy's got gold bullets in him, that's it. They've all got their fingers in the holes. It's an outrageous thing, and I think he must have intended that as a metaphor for how dehumanizing capitalism and greed can be.
And in that scene, and just watching them like rip this guy apart, who they could probably maybe patch back together on the table there, you know, it's the only thing I've ever seen that comes close to it in terms of just ripping into the viscera there is like maybe a zombie film in some way, as they're just ripping their hands and, you know, plunging their hands into this guy's guts and pulling out the gold.
Yeah, we wouldn't see that kind of material, and maybe until Night of the Living Dead couple of years later, and then the Italian zombie films, of course, ran with that. But you're never going to see that sort of thing in a Western, not any other Western that I'm aware of, certainly nothing beforehand.
It was interesting that that scene was cut, and then the scalping had been cut as well. Is this like the definitive cut, or are there other versions of this kind of floating around out there?
I think the one we have now is generally considered to be more or less complete. It's been one of those films that over the years, legends have grown up about, other atrocities that supposedly carried out, bodies roasted over spits and things like that, crazy things. Nobody knows whether anything like that was ever shot. I don't think Questy himself has ever said, yes, I shot a lot more violent material. But as far as I'm aware, this is pretty much complete. There could be maybe the odd frame here or there. Who knows? When a film has been censored as much and as often as this one has, yeah, there could be the odd scene lying around. But it doesn't play in a sort of a choppy way now where you think, hang on, it looks like that scene didn't end correctly. I think there should have been some more shots in there. It seems to flow quite nicely now. So I'm quite happy with this one anyway.
Yeah, and the film looks gorgeous.
Yeah, it does. Questy had Franco Delli Colli, Tonino Delli Colli's brother, to shoot it, and he does a great job. There's some wonderful contrast, especially near the beginning, when they're out in the desert. The sand looks whiter than normal sand, even, and you've got this blazing blue sky. He gets a nice contrast there. And then later on in the town, the interiors have that nice kind of sweaty ambience to them. The visual texture is everything you'd want from an Italian Western. You know, it's sweaty, it's gritty, it's slightly larger than life, and it just has that nice glow of 60s color film. Looks great.
And it has, the one thing that I really appreciate in it is, as we talked a little bit about before, is the stylization. Some of the shots are really stylized, and I really appreciated that and how it adds this interesting element. Like in the barroom scene, there's one example of it that I liked, and it's just a little thing, but you really weren't expecting it. Is especially from an Italian Western, because I mean they're not huge budget films, and it's not to say they're not artless, but at times it just seems that this one they really put a lot of effort into it. And then the barroom scene, there's this camera that follows the bottle that's being slid down the bar to someone, and I thought was really, really well done. And then also the use of framing within the frame, and there's that sort of shootout on the street, and one guy's being framed in between the spokes of this wagon wheel as like a gun's being put to his head. And for some reason, just that shot, I just thought if you just had that as a still, it's just a fascinating thing. So they did a really nice job with sort of the look and the stylization of how the film comes together.
Yeah. All the best directors of Italian Westerns made a bit more of an effort to actually use usually the widescreen frame and to find an unusual way to frame things, because obviously a shootout can be filmed any number of ways, but in a run-of-the-mill Western, and especially in a run-of-the-mill Italian Western, they just tend to peter out or go on too long. Or it's just a bunch of guys shooting each other, and there's not much effort made in terms of the cutting or the angles or the framing. But here, Questy did try and make it unusual, give it its own character. And there's another great shootout when Lillian walks into the town for the first time, and the character of Oakes, who betrayed him at the beginning and is the last member of the gang standing after the townsfolk have killed off all the others. Oakes is making a last stand in this shop. I think it's a shop. And Ian goes in to confront him, and they have this little shootout. And there's an amusing moment that Questy, the director, throws in where Milian, he's ducking down out of range, and he comes up, he stands up, and each time he stands up, on the shelf above his head, there are three different hats. There's a top hat, a bowler hat, another side hat. And each time that Milian bobs up to have a look where his enemy is, it's as if he's putting on each of these hats. A really weird moment in the middle of this shootout. But again, it shows the imagination and the sense of humor that's at play here as well.
The editing as well, as we were talking about how this version of Django Kill that's out now from Blue Underground is the most complete version of it. And in terms of the editing, you were talking about when there were these other versions, it was a little bit choppy and stuff like that. But speaking of choppy, yeah, these flash cuts at the beginning, especially at the beginning scene where we learn a few minutes in, because it kind of repeats itself, what this whole scene is about. There are these really quick cuts that take place that reminded me a bit of Easy Rider, but Easy Rider hadn't come out yet. So just these really sort of experimental, almost underground cinema technique, because I think that would probably be the closest to anything I would have seen or anyone would have seen maybe by 1967 to do that kind of quick flashes and even upside down and backward shots within this really quick section.
Here we have to give a lot of credit to Franco Arcalli, Questi's right-hand man on the movie. He helped him with the script, and was, I know he was a very good friend of his, and co-wrote and edited all of Questi's very, very few films that he made, but he co-wrote and edited all of them. And yeah, Arcalli's work on this is superb. I think they set up right from the beginning, they set up disorientation as a major theme. Millian starts off, he's very disorientated, crawling out of his own grave. And the way it's edited, especially that opening flashback with that montage effect, we can't help but experience his disorientation. We know what's going on here. You know, there's these, like you say, very, very brief shots. I think Questi called it a subliminal style of editing. And it works well to support that theme of disorientation. And also, it just forces the viewer to pay more attention, to try and piece things together and figure out what's going on, because he's not going to give you any easy answers. And the editing in this film and in Questi's other films, I don't know if you've seen Death Laid an Egg or Arcana, I'm pronouncing that correctly, another great film he did in 1972. The editing it's the same subliminal style, as Questi said, using montages, flash cuts, kind of like what I guess maybe Godard perhaps set it off in Abu Dissouf in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. But here it's taken to extremes. You think, what is going on here? I'm really having to work hard to keep up with this. And I think that's another thing that Questi would have intended, you know, keeping his audience off balance and... you know, we really have to pay attention and do our work to get some kind of meaning out of this.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more of our discussion on Django, Django Kill, and the Euro-Western with our special guest, Kevin Grant.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's BOOTH. Visit adamandeve.com today.
All right, now, for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action, I've been asked to relay a request from the Gramercy Riffs. It's a special one for Movie Meltdown. That's how we allow a bunch of movie geeks with a show about some crazy movies. And I do mean Movie Meltdown. Here's a hit with them in mind.
Come check out Movie Meltdown. News, reviews, and interviews about your favorite thing, movies.
$10 for the budget matinee.
The budget matinee.
This is why we don't go to the theater.
That's right.
Come by and check it out at moviemeltdown.com.
I kind of want to be able to mix it up and tie everything into one big conglomerated mess of movie geekdom.
And I don't know if we could. Are.
That's what we are.
Movie Meltdown. For movie geeks, by movie geeks.
Be looking good, Movie Meltdown. You hear me, babies? Good. Real good. Adios.
I'm Dangerous Jamie. Joining me, as always, is Sarah. And we're going to talk to you about why you should be listening to the Gore Press Broadcast.
Let's do that.
Let's, indeed. Why should they be listening to the Gore Press Broadcast?
Well, firstly, because it's awesome, obviously.
Obviously. I mean, that's a given, or a given.
A given, yeah. You can expect nonsensical puns like that.
Yeah. With zero context.
Absolutely zero context.
But also, we review horror films.
Mostly, we review horror films, I would say.
Well, yeah. That's probably the bulk of what we do.
Yep.
We also look at new releases, top five lists.
Yep.
We cover theme months.
Yeah, we do some horror news.
Yeah, tell us about the theme months that we covered.
We have done Horror Behind Bars.
Yeah, we did Clown Town, where we looked at clown movies.
We did. We've done Trash Kings.
Trash Kings, where we looked at the films of Fred Olen Ray, Jim Wynorski, and David Zuccotto.
Yeah, we've done a bunch of stuff. We've got Revenge Month in the works, Trauma Month. So yeah, loads of stuff like that.
Loads of stuff. So if you like horror films, you should probably listen to the Gore Press Scorecast.
Absolutely.
Where here and we're ready to believe you. So that's not all you can get. You can also get extra super bonus content when you subscribe to the feed. Tell about it, Sarah. Tell them now.
We do the Gore Quest Gormantry, which is basically us shamelessly ripping off Mystery Science Theatre. Yeah, basically getting drunk, chatting over the top of a film, and hopefully being quite entertaining, I think.
There are two ways to find the show. You can find us over at iTunes by searching for the new Gore Quest Gorecast.
You can indeed.
Or you can go to gorepress.com and read all the great reviews, news, interviews, and everything all there alongside the podcast.
Yeah.
So come on, subscribe to the new Gore Quest Gorecast. Tune in, drop out, stay spooky.
I'd recommend this show to anybody. Anybody who's into smut.
It was a childhood corrupted by endless hours of VHS rentals.
For sake, the man had shit, you'd love it.
In his most formative years, he had seen it all.
I can handle anything.
Action.
Karate is not to be used aggressively. But if I have no other choice.
Horror. And romance. Now, he's decided it's time to go back. For just one more adventure.
Humans are such an easy prey.
Noel Meller presents...
You're the problem, you little shit!
The Adventures in VHS Podcast.
Join me, Noel Meller, as each month I take an in-depth look at one movie from my collection of ex-rental 80s VHS classics and speak to one or two of the people involved with making them about what the format means to them.
The Adventures in VHS Podcast.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Download today from iTunes by searching for Adventures in VHS or visit adventuresinvhs.com.
That movie was pretty good.
What? That movie gets an MG straight up. Straight up MG material.
Honey, is that Robert De Niro across the street?
Hey, yo.
Sure looks like him. Can't be, though.
Yeah, you.
He's calling to us. Let's just go.
But it's Bobby f***ing D, honey.
Hey, yo. That's right. It's Bobby f***ing De Niro over here. Hey, a lot of people don't know this about me. Yeah, I'm mingling down here with the drug dealers, the pimps, the pushers, the low-level gangsters, you know. Honestly, I'm slinging some shit myself. You may not know this about me, but I'm a fan of podcasts. Yeah, I've been listening to these guys, Bloodbaths and Boomsticks, a couple of knuckleheads from around the way. You got John Smallberries. What a fucking name on this guy. You got Corey G. The guy's fucking half-retarded over here. Likes John Woo, for fuck's sake. Then you got Tim Gross, he's got the movie watching Constitution of a Billy Goat. Hey, find these guys at bloodbathsandboomsticks.blogspot.com. Long fucking name, but just go find it, it's worth it. You knuckleheads got that?
Yeah?
Bloodbaths and Boomsticks, it's on the house.
A place where raffing leprechauns rub shoulders with wrestling women and mad doctors. There is a place where domestic dwellings are terrorized by killer beds and satanically possessed appliances. There is a place where nations battle for survival whilst tasty geezers with shooters and football hooligans run riot upon the streets. There is a place where the underdog strives for sport and glory, whilst hitmen and vampire motorcycles go on curses of bloody revenge. There is a place where Nicolas Cage punches a bear in the face. The name of the place? The Crash and Burn Movie Podcast, of course. www.crashandburnmoviepodcast.co.uk. Be there. And listen to us waffle on. You may be entertained.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents. And you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know. It's messed up, right?
All right, we're back. We're talking about Django Kill with author Kevin Grant. Kevin, so where does this film fit in with the whole Django cycle or films that had Django in the title?
It's difficult. It's difficult because you have to bear in mind, of course, that there was no such thing as a Django series. Producers and distributors saw the success of one film, in this case Django, and they thought, hey, you know, we can just call our movie Django. Let's redub the character. Let's call him Django and sell it as a Django movie. We'll make millions more lyrics. And, of course, that's what happened, not just with Django, but with lots of other characters. So, in that point of view, Django Kill shares very little apart from maybe some generic plot elements, you know, kind of a revenge angle and so on. But I suppose you could say that it has some of the gothic flavor of Corbucci's original Django, which is a heavily gothic film, very dark film, dark skies. Django himself, of course, looks like an undertaker and has all that stuff in the cemetery and so on. And it was a very violent movie, and Django Kill maybe played off of some of that, takes the violence to a new level. It's got some of the morbid air of some of the other Django movies, like 10,000 Blood Money, though not called Django in the title. It has a character dubbed as Django, played as by Gianni Garco. And that film is very morbid. It's kind of obsessed with death and has this peculiar atmosphere of dread hanging over it. There's some of that in Django Kill as well. And also Viva Django, a movie with Terence Hill, also called Get a Coffin Ready. And that's very close to the original Django, almost like a prequel. And there's a similar emphasis there on graveyards, and it's very gothic, and there's lots of flames. Like Django Kill has this great flaming climax. There's a similar thing in Viva Django. So there are a few of the films there you can see where it has a similar flavor, but in general, it's just incidental plot points that it shares with the other movies, because there wasn't actually a uniform series of films.
So you're saying that Django Unchained might not be a direct sequel to the original Django?
I think from what I've read of Tarantino's intentions, you know, he just hooked into the anti-racist angle in particular of Django, Corbucci's Django, with his peculiar red-hooded Klansman, obviously, who kind of take on the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that's sparked Tarantino's imagination, among other things. So that's an angle that he's run with for Django Unchained, and I'd be interested to see how that plays out. And I think he's also taken from other Corbucci movies. He says there's a section in the center of Django Unchained, I've seen some stills that's set in the snow, and Corbucci's other great Italian, well, one of his other great Italian westerns, of course, is The Great Silence. I'm sure you're familiar with that, which takes place entirely in the snow, and that's been another direct inspiration for Tarantino. So I think he's just taken maybe a few of the broad themes, like the anti-racism angle that Django has, and you know, he's put that into Django Unchained. And, I mean, I've yet to see the characterization of Jamie Foxx, whether he has any of the kind of Franco Nero insouciance about him. I've yet to see. So, but it's going to be really interesting to see how he incorporates those elements, as well as maybe the blaxploitation angle. But Django Unchained seems to me quite similar to the plot of, I'm going to say the N-word here, because it's a Tarantino. We're talking about Tarantino, The Legend of Nigger Charlie, with Fred Williamson, an early 70s blaxploitation western where he plays an escaped slave, who, you know, who goes, kind of turns the tables on his white oppressors. So I'm sure that was an inspiration for Tarantino as well. So I'm keen to see how he has interwoven thematic elements from Django and the westerns, and also the blaxploitation genre.
So of all the other films that have Django in the title, what do you think of those? Are they pretty good, or is there one that we should definitely check out, or is this kind of the cream of the crop, the original and Django Kill?
Because so many movies perhaps were written with other characters and other titles, but then when Django was a success, people just started to retitle their movies as Django, whether they had anything in common with the original movie or its character at all. It's difficult to tell. It's a real mixed bag of movies. I would say some of the ones that I've mentioned, I mean, obviously Django Kill is a great movie. It needs to be sought out by anyone who's interested in this area of film. $10,000 Blood Money, which I mentioned, is another great one with Gianni Garco. Viva Django, the Terence Hill movie, that's cool. Django the Bastard, Django the Bastardo, that's a lot of fun. That's reasonably similar to Django Kill, and it's very ambiguous about its title character. Has he come back from the dead? Is he a ghost? Is he a real man? the ambiguity is maintained throughout. It's not as out there stylistically or thematically as Django Kill, but it's a pretty weird movie, and it plays with the supernatural angle, which I think Rob was saying how much he appreciates. And a lot of people said it was an influence on High Plains Drifter. I don't know about that, but it's got that similar play with supernatural, good supernatural themes. So that's a great one. I mean, there are lots of good films among the so-called Django cycle, but as to them relating to Django itself, there aren't that many. There aren't that many. I mean, the only official, I say official, semi-official sequel, supposedly endorsed by Sergio Corbucci and the only one to star Franco Nero, Django Strikes Again, I think it was released as, in the late 80s, doesn't even look like a Spaghetti Western. It was shot in Colombia, if I remember rightly. That's got a lot of elements familiar from the original Django. It's got the machine gun, it's got the cemeteries. It's not a bad movie, but it plays more like an 80s action film than an actual Spaghetti Western. So it's kind of a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag. There are maybe half a dozen or so that could really stand shoulder to shoulder with the original Django.
So were there a lot of series in the Spaghetti Westerns where they would just kind of slap somebody's name on it and kind of try to almost trick the viewer to think that this was part of the same cycle?
Very, very much so. Very much so. And that was part and parcel of the Italian commercial film industry in the early 60s. They'd already done it with hundreds of peplums, you know, the muscle men movies, the so-called historical adventures that they churned out with characters like Hercules and Ursus and Machiste. Some of the mythical characters, some they just made up themselves. And the same sort of thing happened there. You get endless rip-offs and imitations and films which had nothing in common with them, but they just called their characters. Whoever was the most popular character that season, they would rechristen him with that name, put it on the put him out at the cinema, and hope people would buy it and think, hey, it's another Hercules movie, let's go and see that, I like the last one. And it was the same with the Italian Westerns. They had a number of Ringo movies. After you had A Pistol for Ringo and Return of Ringo in 1965, they were very successful, very good films. And a lot of films came out then. Suddenly they had Ringo in the title, you know, especially if they starred the same actor, Giuliano Gemma. A lot of his westerns in Italy, they would suddenly have a new title that boasted that Ringo is back. In fact, he wasn't. And it was the same, obviously, I think Django was the one who inspired the most copycats and imitators and just retitled movies. But it was the same for Ringo, for Sultana as well, with another popular character. He has a great series of films on his own, quite Django-flavored, but a bit more tongue-in-cheek. He's another quite sinister Italian western gunfighter. So there were other movies called Sultana, but he wasn't in them. Sabata, Trinity, the comedy westerns, there were a slew of Trinity movies. The Holy Ghost was another character who came along in the early 70s, and he had a few more films, which nothing like the original, but they called him Holy Ghost because they hoped he could make a few more bucks.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me watching Spaghetti Westerns is, I would say probably next to jazz, that the Western is probably a wholly American art form. It just seems to come out of our mythology, comes out of our history here in the States. And to watch a Spaghetti Western or Euro Western, it's interesting to see someone take the art form that we created and then, you know, filter it a little bit through, and a lot of times, their own sensibilities, their own history, their own culture, their own, you know, things that they're dealing with in society. And with the case of sort of Django Kill, this surrealist element to some extent. As for you, what is it about the Spaghetti Western that's so fascinating?
It's a lot to do with what you were just saying. Here's this most American, quintessential American genres. And I think what the Europeans were trying to do, the ones that really thought about what they were doing anyway, I think what they were trying to do was just to take it back to the essence of the myth, you know, reduce it to a kind of a universal mythic archetype and build upon that, maybe not so much with the settling of the West and other things which are obviously understandably very, very important in American Westerns. They would just add other elements, some of them, you know, of universal interest, anti-racist, or they had a little political theme, which were au courant in the 60s. They were just attuned to the zeitgeist. Their principal themes tend to center on challenges to order and authority, or they criticize or ridicule power structures or orthodoxy. And their heroes were very much 60s heroes. You know, they were cynical opportunists. These weren't heroes. They were cynical opportunists or mercenaries. I think they paved the way for pretty much all of the anti-heroes that we see in today's action movies, you know, with their flippant attitude to death and so on and violence. can see all those in the Italian westerns. And the style, of course, we can't get away with the style that these guys brought to the West. More of a kind of a European art film style. Very few of them were as extreme or concentrated in their stylization as Django Kill, but a lot of them had enough, you know, baroque and loud and brash. And it didn't look like the standard westerns we'd come to expect, certainly by the mid-60s, American westerns, that is. Then you can, along came these colorful, loud, bizarre ersatz westerns, I suppose we have to call them. But they weren't really interested in retelling the same old stories of the settling of the West. They just twisted it around. They had radical politics for a time as well, where they would have half-breed Mexican or full-blood Mexican heroes in the Revolution. And America was the bad guy, or any imperialist state was the bad guy. So it's just fascinating to see how the Western was such an American genre, was subverted and twisted around and looked at just given this new perspective, a European perspective.
I'd have to say that it's probably on par with what the French New Wave did with film noir to some extent.
Yeah, I'd go with that. The stylization, I mean, there's a similar high level of stylization in some of the things that Godard was doing and Jean-Pierre Melville, directors like that, kind of took them out of their American backdrops and just to see how they would play against a European backdrop or with European attitudes. And of course, there's, you mentioned jazz. Jazz is a heavy influence on some of those particularly the French film noirs of the 50s and 60s. So, yeah, there's definitely a similar mindset, I think, behind the two genres.
So how did the book come about? What was the kind of tipping point where you're like, you know, I really want to write about this?
I guess from spending so many years watching and collecting them and thinking about them, just trying to get to the root of what my fascination with them was. And, I'd been writing about them sporadically, but then just decided to collect my thoughts and kind of get it off my back, you know, get it out of my system. It was one of my earliest film obsessions, I think. It grew out of the love of American westerns when I was a kid, but then I saw Fistful of Dollars at a young age and just shocked me completely. This was nothing like the American westerns that I was seeing on TV, and it took off from there. So it was just a way of gathering my thoughts and trying to look at them as a whole, understand why I was fascinated with them, why other people continue to be fascinated with them, why were they so successful, why were there so many of them, why are people still interested? Just a way of trying to make sense of all that for myself, I think.
Yeah, it usually comes out of a love of something like that. And as for that love, I mean, how long did it take you to turn your, you know, obsession on it into something that you had to research and write? Overall, how long did the research and the writing take?
Oh, probably a lot longer than it should have done. About as much time as it took Charles Bronson to track down Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West, I think. It took probably from its inception to when it was published, it was a little over 10 years. That was with researching and writing it. I had to fit it around work and general life. And then about halfway through the process, wouldn't you know it, two kids came along. They take up so much time, don't they, kids? So that also added to the timeline. So I would say it was about 10 years as a part-time thing, never as a full-time thing.
So what's been the reception to the book? It's been out for, what, a couple months now, right?
Reception's been very gratifying. Pleased to note that from what I've reviewed that I've read and what people have told me, they've kind of understood and got what I was trying to do with it, was to put the whole phenomenon into perspective and also to analyze the themes that bind the films together, loosely bind them all together. People do seem to have got what I was trying to do, so that's been quite gratifying.
Where's the best place for people to pick up the book?
I should direct you to the publisher's website, which is www.fabpress.com, fabpress.com. That's Flesh and Blood Publishers. They still want many copies there. It's on Amazon. It should be on all the major book-selling e-tailers. I don't know how well stocked the shops over in the States are. I still see it in the shops. I live just outside London. I still see it regularly in the shops in the centre of London. Hopefully in big bookshops, big bookstores, you'll find it. But Amazon is probably the first port of call.
You know, I have to say that it is probably one of the most well-researched and thorough books on spaghetti westerns I've ever read. I mean, there's the, of course, Frayling doing all of his work on Leone, but I like that you kind of separate out and don't try to tread that same ground and just do such a good job with all of the films outside of Leone and just really pulling all those themes together, and just the way that you approach each chapter is absolutely terrific.
Well, thanks. That's very kind. I mean, obviously, I love the Frayling books. One of the earliest, I got the very first version of his first book on spaghetti westerns, which was, again, very Leone heavy. So there wasn't much point in me trying to, well, I mean, I could try to do my own take of some of Leone westerns, but people have read about Leone's westerns so many times, and the more I got into the genre, the more I discovered that there were enough interesting movies out there that weren't directed by Leone that it would merit this kind of approach, and I wanted to shine the light on some of the other movies, the other directors, writers, actors who contributed to this phenomenon. I mean, Leone made half a dozen, less than that, in fact. Other people made maybe a dozen, or, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of these films is the point, and it doesn't, although Leone is still the benchmark, I think everybody who cared about making these films trying to reach to his level. Very few succeeded, but he remains the benchmark, but there are so many other interesting films out there, so many other angles that they explored, that's why I thought this would be a worthwhile project.
Well, and I like that it's not sensationalistic either, where it's like, ooh, check out these bizarre films, because some of them are absolutely bizarre, but you really delve deeper than that. You know, why did this film come about? Why is it this way? I mean, there's, you know, you can talk about, oh, isn't it weird that The Price of Power took on the Kennedy assassination, yada, 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 but that you kind of go further than that and contextualize things, not only in the politics of the day, but then in the overall film landscape, I think is really a great thing to do.
I think it's important to do that, I think, because like you say, there is a tendency just to kind of view the whole thing as a kind of a freak show. You could probably do a study that just took that approach, these crazy movies, as you were saying. These were the best ones anyway, were made by very intelligent people, committed filmmakers. A lot of them were committed politically and so on. You know, they had their own perspective on things, and that's what I wanted to find out, and that's what I wanted to try and get across, that they weren't all just slavish imitations of American movies. It wouldn't have survived so long, for such a long time. I mean, we're looking early 60s to, well, the last one kind of petered out in the mid-70s, but certainly there were about 5 or 6, 7 years there of hardcore production, hundreds of movies churned out. I don't think they would have been able to sustain themselves for that long if they had just been imitations, either of American Westerns or just imitations of Leone's Westerns. You know, there had to be something else going on there to sustain them for so long.
As for what's up next, what are you currently working on?
I'm working on a book with a friend of mine. This goes back to American Westerns. But we are trying to catalogue and analyse the best or the most interesting revisionist Westerns. Revisionist just meaning American films that subvert the expectations you might have of a Western, which has been also fascinating. Whether they subvert them from a political perspective or in terms of plot, in terms of what the hero does, what doesn't do, that's been also fascinating to delve back into, because American Westerns, you know, were an obsession of mine even before the Italian ones. So to kind of getting to grips with some of the more unusual American Westerns this time.
We're going to take a break and we'll play a preview for next week's show.
What's the big mystery?
Bill, I have seen one or two things in my life. Never anything like this.
You know there is no way on earth that you're going to leave here tonight without taking me with you.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna break in two? I didn't think so. You ever tried with all your heart and soul?
gonna get your lover back to you. Come on, I hope so. You ever pray with all your heart and soul just to watch her walk away?
Suppose I said that all of that was fake.
It's only a dream.
That's right, we're talking about Eyes Wide Shut next week, just in time for Christmas, because you know that ritual orgy scene really reminds me of those holiday office parties we all know and love. So make sure to come back and join us as we welcome in our special guest host, the lovely Lex from Love and Sex with Lex, to talk about Stanley Kubrick's final film, Jealousy, and much, much more.
So you can get that one over at boulevardmovies.com, just as you can get this week's movie, Django Kill If You Live Shoot, from over there. So I want to thank everybody for listening, and I want to thank our special guest this week, Kevin Grant, for coming out to the show and talking to us about spaghetti westerns.
It was a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, thank you. And by the way, you have any gold bullets around?
I used up my last batch.
Yeah, he didn't tear into the guy who he shot afterwards to get him out.
No, I should have thought of that.
And lest we forget, as we did speak about Mr. Tarantino and his new film Django coming out, we do have an opportunity for you to take part in another show related to a Tarantino film. Mr. Mike, would you like to give folks the details?
Sure, yeah. You can call in and leave us your opinions on Mr. Tarantino, about Reservoir Dogs, Django Unchained, any of his other films. You can call us in by, say, early February. Say Groundhog's Day is going to be our deadline, because the show will be airing on February 13th, all about Reservoir Dogs. And you can call in and leave us your thoughts at 734-666-0800. All right, thanks again, everybody, for listening, and be sure to stop by our website, projection-booth.com, where you can listen to this episode and others, and you can go over to iTunes and leave us a review, leave us some stars, consider them gold bullets of love, if you would, and we will talk to you soon.
Shining.